From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. September 11th and the war against terrorism has increased the urgency of restarting the Middle East peace process. At the same time, disillusionment and violence have been on the rise while Israelis are attacked by suicide bombers and Palestinians live under Israeli occupation. On today's Fresh Air, we'll hear from Israeli journalist David Horovitz, editor of the newsweekly The Jerusalem Report, and Palestinian journalist Ghassan Khatib, publisher of Palestine Report Online. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. A federal judge has temporarily blocked a new federal directive intended to undermine Oregon's assisted suicide law. U.S. District Judge Robert Jones granted a temporary restraining order that was requested by Oregon's Attorney General, as well as a doctor, a pharmacist, and three terminally ill patients. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and the Army General running the war effort in Afghanistan say they're satisfied with the progress so far. From the Pentagon, NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
In the Gulf War and even the Kosovo War, U.S. aircraft flew many times the missions that have been flown over Afghanistan so far. Some critics say the bombing should intensify, but Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld points out that in those other wars, U.S. aircraft were based near the theater of operations.
You have to look at the availability of ports, the availability of airfields, and the distances one has to fly. If you can fly an aircraft two or three times in a day, because of the distance being close and the access you have, you're going to get a higher sortie rate.
Most of the fighters used in Afghanistan are based on U.S. aircraft carriers in the Arabian Sea, 6 or 7 hours away. Army General Tommy Franks, who runs the war effort, appeared with Rumsfeld at the Pentagon. Franks said his military campaign has been initiated, but not yet fully executed. Tom Gelton, NPR News, the Pentagon.
The political head of the Afghan opposition says his forces don't need troops sent in from other countries. He says his fighters can deal with the Taliban on their own. NPR's Steve Inskeep reports from Dushanbe, Tajikistan.
Burhanuddin Rabbani left Afghanistan and traveled here, just to the north, to meet the president of Turkey. Turkey is the first predominantly Muslim country to pledge troops to this conflict. Some officials and analysts have also suggested that Turkish troops might be best for any peacekeeping mission if and when the Taliban falls from power. But after the meeting, the nominal leader of the Afghan opposition seemed to suggest that was not a good idea. Rabbani told reporters that the opposition does not require any troops from friendly states. He says the Northern Alliance still only wants financial, logistical, and political help. Northern Alliance military commanders have made similar statements, but they're working more and more closely with U.S. Special Operations troops and U.S. bombers. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, Dushanbe, Tajikistan.
Postal supervisors testified today that they would have shut down a New York City's largest mail processing plant if they believed there was an anthrax threat. The officials appeared at a federal court hearing in New York. Traces of anthrax were found on 5 machines at the facility. The New York Metro Area Postal Union filed suit demanding the giant postal station be closed. 2 supervisors told a judge they relied on the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to assess the risk. Stock prices were mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up 33 points at 95.87. The Nasdaq closed down 10 points. The S&P 500 was up 2. This is NPR News. Officials with the National Abortion Federation, an abortion rights group, say that today nearly 200 clinics around the country received Federal Express packages with a powdery substance inside, along with a letter suggesting it was anthrax. From member station WNPR, Eileen Abrizio reports.
Officials confirm that some of the packages contain letters signed by a group calling themselves the Army of God. The National Abortion Federation and Planned Parenthood Federation of America were falsely listed as the senders. Federal Express is halting the further delivery of similar packages. Connecticut was among the states targeted. Judy Tabar, president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of Connecticut, says numerous offices receive similar packages.
Unfortunately, Planned Parenthood is all too familiar with anthrax threats. For a number of years now, we have been well prepared to deal with this sort of situation. So today, when this happened, our protocol was activated. Staff knew exactly what to do.
Officials in Connecticut say preliminary tests on one package proved negative for anthrax. For NPR News, I'm Eileen Albrizio in Hartford.
The Supreme Court agreed today to decide whether schools may give drug tests to nearly any student involved in after-school activities. Critics say such broad testing is unconstitutional and a step toward universal screening. Supporters say it's necessary in the face of drug use by young people. Congress is being urged to help protect against identity fraud. Experts told lawmakers today that it currently takes too long to release the records of a person who has died. A General Accounting Office official says shortening that time would narrow the window of opportunity for criminals to open new accounts using a deceased individual's identity. I'm Frank Stachow, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from PBS, presenting Life 360. This week, How One Person's Junk is Another's Treasure, featuring comedian Margaret Cho, Friday at 9, local times may vary.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. September 11th and the war against terrorism has increased the urgency of restarting the peace process in the Middle East. Osama bin Laden has adopted the Palestinian cause as part of his agenda, although many Palestinians, including Hanan Ashrawi, have objected to that association. Both Palestinians and Israelis have been suffering during this second intifada. Israelis feel constantly unsafe because of a wave of suicide bombings. By September 10th, there had already been 30 of them this year. Palestinians are living under military occupation, and hundreds of Palestinians have been killed. A little later, we'll hear from Palestinian journalist Ghassan Khatib. Our first guest is David Horovitz, editor of the Israeli news magazine, The Jerusalem Report. He's also author of the book, A Little Too Close to God. He's lived in Israel since emigrating from England in 1983. I asked him to describe the range of reaction in Israel after the attacks of September 11th.
The main reaction in Israel was utter horror and a kind of weird sense of identifying with the nature of the attack, at the same time as people realized that this was something beyond anything that they had encountered here. I think people were once the initial shock had passed, they were trying to sort of draw parallels and proportions and realizing really that the scale of those attacks was amounted almost to sort of the equivalent to all the Israeli losses in the year of conflict with the Palestinians. And it was so much worse because it was as though somebody had attacked the Israeli Parliament building or some other kind of symbol of the state here as well. So the sense of identification was diminished by the realization that we had encountered nothing like this here.
Has the American war against terrorism changed daily life in any way in Israel?
I'm not sure that it has, and I wonder actually if Israelis would say that they're unhappy that it hasn't, because I think that initially, at least, the sense in Israel was, wow, finally now the Americans in their terrible pain will understand what we've been talking about and going through, that the natural trust that you have when you go about your daily life, that the people you're encountering don't want to kill you, that trust has been shattered, as Israelis feel it has been shattered for them. And there was a sense, I think, that America and Israel would now be leading the charge against the people who don't cherish the right to life. And what I think Israelis worry about is that not only is there no such partnership, but there's a fear that the Americans are concentrating on a very limited objective and are, in fact, for now at least, whitewashing some of the other sources of terrorism, which Israelis would regard as regimes like Iran and Syria, and indeed Yasser Arafat's Palestinian Authority, which at the very least, I would say almost all Israelis believe, fosters terrorism if it doesn't actually participate in it.
Now, I want to get back to that in a couple of minutes. Do you think that terrorism has escalated at all since the 11th, or do you think that the escalation has just been since the new intifada that started over a year ago?
The attacks that Israel has been facing, I would say, have not escalated in a significant way, except psychologically. That's that after September 11th, in October, Palestinian gunmen killed an Israeli minister, and that was unprecedented, that they assassinated the minister of tourism in a Jerusalem hotel. But in terms of the day-to-day conflict, that had been causing its relentless death toll for almost a year before September the 11th, and on it still goes.
What are some of the things that you feel you can't do now, or places that you feel it's unsafe to go now since the Second Intifada?
Well, I'll give you a very personal example. Shortly before this, what we'll call the New Intifada, erupted a year ago, along with tens of thousands of other Israelis, I would take my family out into the West Bank sometimes. Just a few weekends before the Intifada erupted, we went out to Bethlehem, which is all of 10 minutes from my house. And I've got three young kids, and I'm not a foolhardy father, I don't think. It was safe. We drove into Bethlehem. We had lunch in a restaurant. We toured the city. We went to some places we hadn't seen for years because the places had been in territory that was too dangerous for years. A Palestinian kid jumped into the car at one point to show us the way. We asked a couple of Palestinian policemen for directions at a certain point, and there was nothing bizarre about this at all. This was normal interaction. And at that time, of course, tens of thousands of Palestinians were coming into Israel every day to work. Well, now, if anyone is foolish enough to try and enter Bethlehem or any other Palestinian city in a car with yellow Israeli registration plates, it becomes remarkable if they emerge unscathed. A few weeks ago, there was an Israeli, I think he was a parachutist or a hang glider pilot, drifted into the center of Ramallah, and it was front page news in Israel that he wasn't killed. Because, of course, if there's an image that has probably scarred Israelis as much or more than others in this intifada, it's the image of the two Israeli reservists who strayed last year into Ramallah by mistake and were battered to death in a police station in the city. And people just don't, you can't go now. You can't. There is no interaction. The level of hostility is just too deep.
Americans are trying to adjust to the threat of terrorism. It's something that Israelis have lived with for a long time. Are there ways in which you feel you've adjusted, and other ways in which you feel you have not?
Well, you never really adjust, but you tell yourself that you are, and you tell yourself that you're carrying on. And you do become a little desensitized, because that's the only way to carry on. I'm not sure how much of the daily assault really reaches American ears, because, you know, I'm sure most people will have been aware that there was a suicide bombing outside a nightclub in Tel Aviv in June, and that there was a pizzeria blown up in central Jerusalem 2 months later. But really, every day there are attacks. There was a suicide bombing foiled this week in Jerusalem. The guy was intercepted in the car that was bringing him and his explosives into Jerusalem. A Palestinian gunman opened fire on a bus, a civilian bus in northern Jerusalem, also this week, killed two Israeli teenagers, almost killed the Arab bus driver, whose life was saved, actually, by a Jewish medic. But it goes on every day, and we have got to the stage in Israel where you simply, you cannot stay in your home and not go out and just panic, because you'd never go out. The threat is there all the time. There are threats every day, there are attacks every day, and you cannot give in to them. You have to go about your business. I think very telling in terms of a sort of image for that is the fact that the pizzeria Sparrow at the junction of King George and Jaffa Road in Jerusalem, which is probably the most popular crossroads in the country, the best-known junction in the country, that pizza restaurant reopened a month after it was blown up. 15 people were killed, and the owners said the way to beat terrorism is to simply carry on as usual. They rebuilt the restaurant. The Arabs and Jews who worked there before work there again now. Nobody quit. As far as I know, a few of the Israelis have been called into the army since the just happened to have been called up. They're of that age, in their late teens, but the same people work there, and the actual business has actually improved in the restaurant. More people go there because they want to show that they will not be deterred.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Horovitz. He's the editor of the Israeli news magazine, The Jerusalem Report. He's lived in Israel since emigrating there from England in 1983. He's also the author of the book A Little Too Close to God. Now, Hezbollah and Hamas, the two major groups that have targeted Israel, were not included on the Bush administration's list of terrorist organizations that the coalition will fight. Although just a few days ago, the Bush administration authorized the U.S. Treasury Department to freeze the assets of Hezbollah and Hamas. What's the range of reaction to Israel to whether Hezbollah and Hamas should be included on the list of terrorist groups?
Israelis are, I would say, would definitely consider Hezbollah and Hamas to be dangerous terrorist organizations that are prepared to target civilians and that are openly, avowedly committed to the destruction of Israel, and that need to be choked of resources, of ability to operate, support, and so on. Hezbollah fought Israel for years in the south of Lebanon when Israel occupied what was called the security zone in southern Lebanon. More than a year ago, Israel withdrew all its troops from Lebanon to the international border in partnership with the United Nations, and Hezbollah continues to target and attempt to target Israel across the border. It's not a case of seeking to liberate occupied territory. The same applies to Hamas. Hamas from Gaza and from the West Bank is consistently attempting to carry out attacks on Israeli, not just Israeli soldiers, not even on Israeli settlers who are living in territory that most of the international community would not consider to be Israeli territory, but to also target civilians inside sovereign Israel. Hamas is openly committed to the elimination of Israel, opposed Yasser Arafat and the Oslo process because that provided for coexistence between Palestine and Israel. So Israel would want these groups to be prevented from operating.
Last month, the Israeli Prime Minister Sharon accused President Bush of basically selling out Israel in order to keep the coalition together. Is that a popular sentiment in Israel?
Sharon warned Bush and the rest of the supposedly enlightened international community not to sell out Israel and feared that there was an effort that would be appeasing the Arab world at Israel's expense. I would say that many Israelis would have considered it somewhat unfortunate that Sharon went public with parts of that speech. However, I think a lot of Israelis would identify with the underlying plea and sense of frustration in those remarks, the sense that Israel is once again, as it was during the Gulf War, being asked unreasonably to constrain and restrain itself when its civilians are being attacked.
I don't know if you saw this, but New York Times columnist Tom Friedman wrote a piece a few weeks ago that basically said America has been such a supporter of Israel that now what the Israelis should do is just ask, what can we do to help? And leave it at that.
Yeah, I think that's fine. And I think if behind the scenes Israel was being assured that sooner rather than later, the American-led coalition will focus its attention on the groups in our neighborhood that are targeting our civilians, then I think Israel would probably be more prepared to do that. But there isn't a sense like that. There's a sense that America has engaged in an operation that is having, at the very best, mixed results in Afghanistan, that it has not demanded any reasonable price from the Arafat regime for it being left alone for the time being, and that it's unreasonable to ask Israel to sit on its hands while its civilians are being killed. I mean, people are being killed every day here. And it's all very well for Tom Friedman to sit wherever he sits and tell Israel that, as a friend of America, it needs to put up and shut up. I would not be prepared to do that. And I don't think he would be prepared to do that if he had to take his heart in his mouth every time his kid went off on a school trip, or every time he got into his own car, or every time he went to work or walked down the street. Just to make it personal, and everybody has these stories. There have been car bombs at the crossroads around the corner from my house. The French Hill attack is somewhere where right where I used to live. A restaurant was blown up in Jerusalem on a street that all of us have walked down. These are not some kind of vague, marginal threat. These are very real threats. We start the day here in Israel absolutely uncertain whether we are going to end it.
Some Israelis have said they think that the United States has a double standard, that the United States is bombing Afghanistan to try to stop terrorism, but that the United States has criticized Israel for going into the West Bank or Gaza to get people they think are terrorists. Is that a generally held feeling in Israel?
Yes, it's a very widely held feeling in Israel. There's a sense in Israel that parallel that Sharon has tried to draw, really, between the Taliban and Yasser Arafat's Palestinian Authority is a valid parallel, that just like the Taliban, Arafat's regime is fostering terrorism, is refusing to arrest people who are right now planning attacks on Israeli civilians, and that Israel is doing exactly what America is doing. It's asked Arafat to arrest the bad guys, much as America asked the Taliban to hand over Osama bin Laden. It has been met with mockery and derision and non-cooperation. It has therefore sent crack troops and helicopters and so on to do the job itself, to prevent further attacks on its civilians with some success, and in return has been castigated by the American administration, told not to send its troops into Palestinian areas as though the Arafat regime were as pure as the driven snow, when all it is doing is exactly what the Americans are doing in Afghanistan.
My guest is Israeli journalist David Horovitz, editor of the newsweekly The Jerusalem Report. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is David Horovitz. He's the editor of the Israeli news magazine, The Jerusalem Report. He's lived in Israel since emigrating from England in 1983. He's also the author of the book, A Little Too Close to God. What would you say is the state of the peace movement now in Israel? Is there still an active peace movement?
There is, but it's been very marginalized. And you're speaking to somebody here who, for example, in the book I wrote last year, was very optimistic and I remain a supporter of compromise. The problem that Israelis in the center and center left of the spectrum face is, if they're honest with themselves, they sense that Yasser Arafat really betrayed this process. And that takes us back, as every assessment of what has happened in Israel the last year must take us back, to Camp David. Because at the Camp David summit in the summer of the year 2000, as far as Israelis from the center-left, quite a long way over to the left and all the way over to the right, their sense is that Arafat at Camp David proved that he didn't really want to make peace with Israel. Because as far as we understand what happened at Camp David and at the subsequent talks at Tabor and other locations, Israel offered to end the occupation, sought to end the occupation, to partner the Palestinians towards statehood on almost all of the territory that Yasser Arafat was seeking, all of the Gaza Strip, almost all of the West Bank, and a partnership in Jerusalem. And that wasn't enough. What we understand is that Arafat insisted, first of all, on attempting to sever Jews and Israel from any links to the Temple Mount, which is the holiest site in Jerusalem, as well as being the third holiest site in Islam, and also that Yasser Arafat, and this is really where people abroad, I often think, don't get this and don't understand this because it's so unbelievable. Yasser Arafat insisted on a right of return, as he calls it, for potentially 3.7 million Palestinians, refugees, not to come and live in the Palestinian state that he wanted to establish, but inside Israel. And that, of course, given that the population of Israel is 5 million Jews and 1. Something million Arabs, would mean the end of Israel as a Jewish state. So as far as Israelis are concerned, at Camp David, Arafat really proved that when he purportedly accepted coexistence with Israel, he was cheating us. And he didn't want Israel and Palestine side by side, but in fact wanted a new Palestine and gradually to overrun Israel and turn it into a Palestine as well. And the vast majority of Israelis are utterly and possibly irrevocably disillusioned with Yasser Arafat. They feel he failed his people. They don't think he told his people that Israel wanted to partner the Palestinians towards statehood. And they think that he bears direct personal responsibility for the awful unfolding of day-to-day bloodshed and violence that we have suffered for more than a year now.
At the same time that there's a growing disillusionment in Israel about the peace process, I think there's a growing despair among Palestinians about the peace process. I think many, perhaps even most Palestinians, feel that their lives have just gotten worse in the past year, that they're living under occupation, they can't get out, they can't get to work, they have no basic freedoms anymore. And so Palestinians are, I think, I don't want to generalize too much, but I think many Palestinians find themselves just getting angrier at Israel.
Yes, and I don't, and I have a lot of sympathy for Palestinian anger, but they're directing it in the wrong place. They need to be directing it at the leader who, in my opinion, and I've had conversations on this radio station with Palestinian journalists in Gaza who have told me and listeners that I was lying, that Barak didn't offer to partner the Palestinians towards statehood and that Barak didn't offer to relinquish almost all the territory. Well, that's because their leadership never told them the truth. Because their leadership has incited against Israel, because their leadership has not dealt with them honestly, because their leadership missed the opportunity of a moderate Israeli prime minister ready for not only the best offer that Israel had ever made, the maximum offer that Israel can ever make without destroying itself, without committing suicide as a Jewish entity. Their leadership failed to end the occupation. And yes, of course their life is terrible now. And there have been 800 Palestinian casualties and 200 Israeli casualties. And the solution isn't, oh, there should have been more Israelis. The solution is nobody should have been dying here and nobody needed to have been dying here. And we all know where the middle ground solution runs. We know that basically, in the end, when there is common sense and readiness for compromise on the Palestinian side, as there was on the Israeli side, there will be territorial compromise, there will be no right of return, as the Palestinians call it, for refugees to the state of Israel, and there needs to be a partnership over Jerusalem. We can all draw the lines where the compromise has to run, and it is the tragedy of the Palestinian people, as much as maybe even more than the Israeli people this past 14, 15 months, that their leadership was too cowardly or too pig-headed or too, I don't know, thought that it could push the Israelis a little further. I would guess that cowardice figured fairly high and a desire not to go down in history as somebody who compromised on some of the Palestinian goals, and instead of which, I'm sorry to say, Arafat will go down in history as the man who failed his people and got a lot of people killed who didn't have to die.
Sari Nusseibeh, who's been a Palestinian negotiator and Palestinian spokesperson, has said that he thinks Palestinians have gotten too extreme. And he said a few weeks ago, we're telling the Israelis, we want to kick you out. It's not that we want liberation, freedom, and independence in the West Bank and Gaza. We want to kick you out of your home. And in order to make sure that Israelis get the message, people go out to a disco or a restaurant and blow themselves up. The whole thing is just crazy, ugly, totally counterproductive. The secret is to get Israel's to side with you. We lost our allies. I believe you spoke with Sari Nusseibeh before coming to the studio for our interview today, yes?
Actually, I didn't because he rescheduled and I'm meeting with him tomorrow, but I did speak to him last week, actually.
And?
Well, Sari Nusseibeh is the kind of Palestinian leader with whom Israel could have made peace a year ago, and with whom Israel will presumably make peace, I hope, sooner rather than later, because Sari Nusseibeh also says that the Palestinians blew it at Camp David, that the Palestinians should not have been holding out for a right of return. He asks the question that all Israelis ask, what is a two-state solution if the Palestinians are demanding that millions of their people come to live in Israel? Now, I personally believe that Sari Nusseibeh is one of the few voices of moderation. I think the Palestinians, I hope, will get behind people like him. Rather than that, though, I fear that he is taking tremendous personal risks in setting out such moderate positions.
David Horovitz is the editor of The Jerusalem Report and author of the book A Little Too Close to God. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Thunder and Lightning, Cracking Open the Writer's Craft by Natalie Goldberg, author of Wild Mind. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with Ghassan Khatib, a Palestinian journalist and teacher living in the occupied West Bank, and we continue our conversation with Israeli journalist David Horovitz. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Israeli journalist David Horovitz, editor of the newsweekly The Jerusalem Report. He's also the author of the book A Little Too Close to God, which he describes as an account of the thrills and panic of a life in Israel. It seems that particularly since the Second Intifada started over a year ago, that just about the only interactions between Israelis and Palestinians has to do with the occupation. You know, that Israelis in the military see Palestinians when Israelis have guns or tanks trained on them, and Palestinians see Israelis when they have Israeli guns pointed at them. This is not a great way for people to learn to respect each other. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about that, about how the predicament, the occupation, is kind of a recipe for escalating distrust and hatred.
Well, first of all, you're right. The situation is dire. This is not a little blip. This is a slipping back of a generation. It was a very prolonged process that took the sides to Camp David last year. But by Camp David last year, the vast majority of Israelis were ready for extraordinary compromises, and that summit failed. And in the wake of that summit, first of all, Israelis will be very hard-pressed now. It would take a lot of convincing them to be prepared to compromise. And the hostility that month after month of direct confrontation has wrought means that average Israelis and Palestinians deeply revile each other now. Israelis feel very much that the whole explanation for this is that the Palestinian leadership failed to take the chance to make peace. But of course, as every death occurs and every day goes by, that context becomes progressively less relevant, and you're left only with the endless violence and the endless hatreds. Now, there is a way out of this. The way out of this, really, is for the international community and primarily the United States to turn up the pressure. Now, obviously, I'm speaking from an Israeli perspective, but it seems to me fairly evident that the pressure, first and foremost, has to be directed at the Palestinian leadership. And let me just give you one little example of why this is not really a conflict where you've got to look at both sides and say they've both got to stop. The Palestinians have to stop. Then the Israelis will stop automatically. And here's the proof. You know, for months there were reports of daily clashes and shooting between Gilo and Bet Jala on the southern edge of Jerusalem. Gilo is a Jewish neighborhood built on land captured in 1967. Bet Jala is Palestinian territory just across the valley. And this was reported in most of the international media as though both sides kind of fired at each other now and again. But the fact is, on every occasion, the shooting started from Bet Jala, and Israeli tanks and soldiers protecting the Jewish neighborhood of Gilo fired back. And for months, Israel begged the Palestinian Authority to stop the gunmen from operating in Bet Jala. Nothing was done. Eventually, the Israeli army moved into Bet Jala. International protests, horrified appeals from the Palestinians. Behind the scenes, a deal was brokered where Arafat said, yes, I will put a stop to the shooting. The army pulled out, and hey presto, there was no more shooting. The same thing has occurred in Hebron. The same thing is starting to occur now in the individual cities that Israel is leaving after re-entering them after the assassination of the tourism minister. There needs to be pressure on Arafat to rein in the dangerous militant people, the people who are leading gangs of gunmen and who are sitting around in garages right now making bombs. If that pressure is placed on Arafat, if Israel feels it can be more secure without huge concentrations of troops in the West Bank, those troops will pull out.
Since the Second Intifada, many more Palestinians have died than Israelis, something like 800 to 200. I mean, it looks like the Palestinians have suffered a lot more than the Israelis, looking at those numbers.
Well, I just think that nobody should have been dying, and I don't think things would be better if four times as many Israelis, God forbid, had died. All the deaths were avoidable and have helped no one and changed nothing. Yes, the Israeli army is stronger than the Palestinian police force, but the solution is not for a greater balance of death. The solution is for an end to the violence and a return to an attempt at dialogue.
Now, although Israel is often the target of terrorist attacks, many Palestinians see Israelis as terrorists because of the occupation, because there are so often Israeli military men, Israeli soldiers who shoot Palestinians. I wonder if you feel any empathy for that.
I feel that every person who's died here for the last over the last 14 months has been an absurd and unnecessary and futile and terrible and tragic death. But I would remind Palestinians who criticize the Israeli presence at roadblocks in the West Bank, around the West Bank cities, that the Israelis were not there a year and a bit ago. They had pulled out. As of the end of 1995, the major West Bank cities were controlled, had been controlled by Yasser Arafat. The Israeli effort, the Israeli direction has been to disengage from the Palestinians. On the first day at Camp David, the map, all sides agree, the map that Barak presented on the first day as the working map showed the entire Gaza Strip in Palestinian hands and 88% of the West Bank in Palestinian hands. That was the opening day map. Israel has been trying to end the occupation. It is the Palestinian leadership of Yasser Arafat that has prevented Israel from doing so. It sounds absurd, doesn't it? It sounds like double talk. I'm telling you, I'm speaking here as a moderate, as somebody who supported and supports the peace process, who voted for Yitzhak Rabin, who voted for Ehud Barak, and would be prepared for all the compromises that I was prepared for in the past. We have not been able to find a partner on the other side who wanted to end this conflict with us in a way that would enable us to continue to exist as a Jewish state. That's our only criteria. We want to be allowed to go on existing as we partner the Palestinians towards their statehood. There hasn't been a leadership here that wanted to do it with us.
You were drafted into the Israeli military in 1990. And one of the jobs, I believe, that you had in the military was as a guard in a Palestinian prison camp, yes?
A guard in an Israeli prison in Gaza where the inmates were Palestinians, yeah.
What impact did it have on you to guard an Israeli prison camp for Palestinians? And I guess what I'm trying to get at here is when people are mostly separated, mostly kept apart, and see each other only in circumstances like prisons or occupations, it's not a recipe for understanding and goodwill. Do you feel like you were changed by being put in that position of being a prison guard?
Oh, first of all, I loathed it, of course, and if I hadn't had to do it as part of my military service, I certainly would have done everything I could to avoid doing it. It was a dreadful place. What was starkly noticeable was the way it was a holding jail. In other words, it was kind of first port of call for any Palestinian arrested for anything. And remember, these were the years of the first Intifada, what we must now call the genuine Palestinian public protest against the Israeli presence inside the cities, which of course is not the situation today, which is why the current Intifada is so much less justifiable. But anyway, this was a first port of call, and you saw Palestinian kids of sort of 14, I would say, being brought in and being placed together with much more hardened and more dangerous people. And you saw the way these kids started to walk differently and talk differently because of the quote-unquote exalted company that they were keeping. And of course, the prison was an incubator for hatred. And on the Israeli side, it was demeaning and brutalizing and unpleasant for all of us who had to serve there. And it certainly didn't change my opinions, but it certainly underlined my sense that there is nothing to be gained by a continuing Israeli presence on Palestinian territory, and that we have to find a way to separate and allow the two nations to flourish independently of each other.
Wait, now let me stop you. What about that experience made you feel more strongly that there needed to be two states and that Israel needed to end the occupation?
Well, because for goodness sake, what was the Israeli army doing in Gaza anyway, where there are a million Palestinians and maybe 6,000 Jews? Common sense and pragmatism requires that you allocate and divide the territory in a way where most of the people of the Palestinian people live in the areas where mostly they live right now, and most of the Jews live in the areas where mostly they live right now. And that's the tragedy of everything we're going through now, because there is a solution. You have to find a territorial compromise and allow two states to flourish side by side.
David Horovitz, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
David Horovitz is the editor of the news weekly The Jerusalem Report and author of the book A Little Too Close to God. Coming up, Palestinian journalist Ghassan Khatib. This is Fresh Air. Israeli journalist David Horovitz just spoke with us about the terrors of living through a wave of suicide bombings in Israel. My guest, Ghassan Khatib, is a Palestinian journalist living under Israeli occupation in the West Bank. He's publisher of the Palestine Report Online and is the director of the Jerusalem Media and Communication Center. David Horovitz said that the reason for the Israeli military occupation is that although Arafat has promised to deal with suicide bombers and snipers, he hasn't, forcing the Israeli military to respond. I asked Ghassan Khatib for his response to that.
I think this is a partial treatment of the much wider problem. I think the whole event, whether it is the Israeli violence or the Palestinian violence, are happening within the general context of the ongoing Israeli occupation to the Palestinian territories, which is now 34 years old occupation. And the Palestinians have been trying all possible means to end that occupation. The Palestinians went along with the peace process for 10 years, hoping that this will be enough to end this occupation in peaceful means. Unfortunately, what we got in these 10 years were only increasing the Israeli illegal Jewish settlements that are erected and built on land that are confiscated by the virtue of force from the Palestinian farmers, which is about consolidating the occupation. So the Palestinians, who might be making lots of mistakes, but they are doing the right and the wrong acts in the context of trying to fight by whatever possible means this Israeli occupation. It's about time, actually, to have an international peace initiative that will be consistent with the international law and with the relevant or the relative Security Council resolution, particularly 242, which calls for ending the occupation in return for full peace and recognition of the State of Israel in the Middle East, with some effort, some international efforts, some international political weight behind some such initiative, because when the parties are left on their own, unfortunately, all what we get is more and more of this ongoing vicious circle of violence.
Now, what David Horovitz and many other Israelis say is that they feel like they've been lied to or taken advantage of, in the sense that they feel that Israel made a lot of concessions and came up with a very good deal at Camp David, and that in return they were slapped in the face by Palestinians who didn't follow through and started up with suicide bombings. In fact, what Horovitz was saying was that he thinks that a lot of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza don't really understand exactly what the Israelis were offering at Camp David, because Arafat hasn't given a very clear accounting of that, nor has the Palestinian media.
This is completely incorrect, because the Palestinians in the Palestinian territories are more exposed to the Israeli media and to the statements of the Israeli politicians than being exposed to the Palestinian media. And I think our friend Horovitz do know that some of the surveys that our center did showed that there is more Palestinians who watch Israeli TV than those who watch Palestinian TV. The Palestinians do understand exactly all what the Israelis has to do to say about the story of Camp David negotiations. And because they know that offer, they supported their leaders' rejection of this offer. Because the negotiations here is not about negotiations between lawyers over real estate in order to bargain over percentages of hectares or dunams. The problem is a problem of a homeland that is under occupation.
One of the things the Palestinians want is the right of return, the right of millions of Palestinian refugees to return to what is now Israel. And that would mean that Palestinians would outnumber Israelis and Israel would no longer be a Jewish state. In other words, Israel would no longer be Israel as we know it. Do you think that's going to forever be a sticking point, or do you think there's a compromise way around that?
First of all, this is not what the Palestinians are asking for. This is only what the Israelis are trying to put in our mouth. And I challenge anybody, if any Palestinian leader has said that he wants those 4 or 6 million Palestinians to return. All what we are saying is that we have to find a just solution to the refugees' problem. And that just solution should be in accordance with the international law, whatever the international law is, whatever the relevant Security Council resolutions on this issue are. And in this regard, we think that those Palestinian refugees has to be treated in a fair way. Some of them probably needs to be compensated. Some of them probably needs to be resettled wherever they are. Some of them maybe needs to be offered an attractive passport to some country. Some of them should be absorbed in the forthcoming Palestinian state, and some of them should be guaranteed the right to return to their homeland, which is now Israel. Now, the quantity of those who should return back to Israel should be negotiated in a way that should take into consideration the vital interests of the two sides, including the state of Israel. This is what we are saying. But Israel is refusing to recognize the principle of the right of return and refusing to deal in principle with any return, even for one single Palestinian refugee, which is not going to lead us anywhere, because leaving the problem of the refugees unsolved will keep the whole conflict unsolved, because the majority of the Palestinian people are refugees. Those refugees who has been kicked out of their houses for 50 years needs to be treated in accordance with the international law.
I recently interviewed Charles Sennett, who spent a few years as the Boston Globe's Middle East correspondent. He left that position just a few months ago. And he was saying that in his observation, this second intifada is much more Islamic fundamentalist in nature. It has more of an Islamist agenda than the first intifada did. And I wonder if you could comment on that.
First of all, this intifada has come as a result of the failure of the peace process. So the fact that the peace process failed and the fact that the relations between the two sides became confrontational rather than peaceful negotiation played to the hand of the opposition of the peace process, including the Islamic fundamentalists. The secular tendencies within the Palestinian society and the current leadership were telling the Palestinian people that we can achieve the end of the occupation by peaceful means. Now, they failed, which gave the upper hand to those who kept saying in the last 10 years that Israel only understands the language of power, and when you negotiate with Israel, they will only increase their settlements on our territories and so on. So, yes, unfortunately, the failure of the peace process is naturally playing to the hand of the opposition groups, including the Islamists in our society.
I think there's a lot of Israeli disillusionment now with Yasser Arafat, and I'm wondering how he's regarded among Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank now, both as a peace negotiator, but also as the head of the Palestinian Authority, you know, as the group that's ruling Gaza and the West Bank now.
Well, now anybody who is in Arafat's position would be in trouble. Arafat is having internal difficulties recently because he is under pressure from inside and outside. From outside, Israel, the Americans, the Europeans have been putting him in pressure in order to stop and to prevent any act of resistance against the Israelis. While at the same time, the Palestinian public, who has been under tremendous pressure from the occupation and its practices and atrocities, are refusing these restraints that are imposed by Arafat against their resistance and reaction to the Israeli ongoing siege and assassinations and so on. So Arafat, when he is pressurized to stop the resistance, he's not given anything to empower him internally and enable him to be convincing to his people.
My guest is Palestinian journalist Ghassan Khatib. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ghassan Khatib, publisher of the Palestine Report Online. He lives in the West Bank. Hanan Ashrawi, who is a Palestinian activist and had been a spokesperson for the peace delegation several years ago and had worked with the Palestinian Authority, she recently commentated on Osama bin Laden's adoption of the Palestinian cause, because he's now including the Palestinian cause as one of his causes. She said about that, "Our cause is not up for grabs. You do not have the right to use it for your ends. We have been victims all our lives, and we do not condone the victimization of others." Is this a popular opinion among Palestinians now?
I think most of the Palestinians will agree on that. The Palestinian society, by large, is a secular society. That's why bin Laden's appeal to the Palestinian people and to the Palestinian cause did not attract the attention of the majority of the Palestinians here, who don't feel that we have much in common with the Afghanis. I have to remind you that this Palestinian cause is very popular and very credible in our region. And anybody who wants to extract public sympathy and credibility would try to link his cause with the Palestinian cause. That's why I believe it would be useful not only for the Palestinians and the Israelis, but also for different superpowers and for the cause of peace worldwide in general, to bring to an end this injustice that the Palestinians have been living in by helping ending this Israeli occupation. And I'm sure this will be enough to bring about serious and real peace and hopefully consequently economic prosperity in the Middle East.
I want to ask you about something that Sari Nusseibeh said. He's been a Palestinian spokesperson and participated in earlier rounds of peace talks. And he was commentating on what he thinks is the more extremist end of the Palestinian movement. He said, "We're telling the Israelis, we want to kick you out. It's not that we want liberation, freedom, and independence in the West Bank and Gaza. We want to kick you out of your home. And in order to make sure that the Israelis get the message, people go out to a disco or restaurant and blow themselves up. The whole thing is just crazy, ugly, totally counterproductive. The secret is to get Israelis to side with you. We've lost our allies." Is that a popular opinion in Palestine now, that in the Gaza and West Bank now, that things have gone too far and that it's counterproductive, and that we, you know, that Palestinians need Israel as an ally in peace talks?
Well, the problem is that this is a little bit late, because we have been all saying this during the peace process, and bringing back the relations into confrontational ones strengthened the argument of the extremists and weakened the arguments of the peace camp.
You live in the West Bank. Tell us where you live and how your day-to-day life has been changed by the Israeli military presence there.
I live in Ramallah, which is one of the most prominent towns, which is only 10 miles from Jerusalem. And I teach in a nearby university, which is 7 miles from the town where I live, Bir Zeit University. But unfortunately, since the beginning of this intifada, Israel has put all of us, the 3 million Palestinians, under siege. And we feel like animals being kept in big cages. So nobody is allowed to leave his town or village. So, for example, we haven't been able to go to our university, and whoever has his school for his children in the same village or town, then he's lucky. Otherwise, students are deprived from going to their schools if it's in outside the village. There has been a tremendous effect of this closure on all our aspects of life. Half of the Palestinian people became under the poverty line as a result of the economic suffering that is resulted from the economic sanctions and the closure. In addition, there has been a harsh Israeli policy in terms of shelling and killing. So far, the Israelis have killed 800 Palestinians in this year of Intifada and injured 22,000 Palestinians.
As you've pointed out, the What's making Palestinians angriest right now is the Israeli occupation. And on the Palestinian side, this is the greatest impasse in the peace process. On the Israeli side, the problem is the suicide bombings in Israel. Is there anything that you think could be or should be done on the Palestinian side to try to stop the suicide bombings?
Yes. There is one thing that can be done which can stop all Palestinian violence, which is ending the Israeli occupation, or a political prospect about the possibility or the hope of an end for that occupation. Because when the Palestinians were invited to the peace process, they got the impression that this is going to bring them sooner or later an end of this occupation. So they dropped all kind of violence, absolutely. To the extent that a prominent Israeli journalist called Danny Rubenstein, coincidentally a few weeks before the beginning of the Intifada, reminded the Israeli people that the last violent Palestinian activity against the Israelis were 4 years ago. But when this peace process collapsed and the Palestinians lost the hope of ending this occupation peacefully, and when Barak allowed Sharon to enter the Palestinian Holy Mosque of Jerusalem by force, violence erupted again from the two sides. So it's either, if there is no end of occupation, the Palestinian public should be part of a peace process that will give the impression, the hope, about a possible peaceful solution to this conflict.
Well, Ghassan Khatib, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Ghassan Khatib is the publisher of the Palestine Report Online and director of the Jerusalem Media and Communication Center. Earlier in the show, we heard from Israeli journalist David Horovitz. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Roberta Sharak, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with one of the greatest living sleight-of-hand artists, Ricky Jay. He's a scholar of magic, con games, sideshows, and eccentric entertainers. He's also an actor. He co-stars in David Mamet's new film, Heist. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.